In 1979, Ulan Mitchell Jr. founded a new religious order centered on black nationalist ideals. He called it the House of Yahweh and rechristened himself Yahweh Ben Yahweh.
And they got nerve to give this, excuse my French, motherfucker a Yahweh Ben Yahweh day.
As Yahweh's notoriety grew, so did his followers and his power. Soon he began demanding more and more from his congregation.
Most people don't question their preacher, because they question your preacher is almost like saying, you're questioning God.
Yahweh expected total obedience, and those who strayed from the flock would have to pay the ultimate price.
That was the beginning of the reign of terror on the city of Miami.
Hi, I'm Joey Dowd.
And I'm Kareem Tapsch.
Beaches, nightlife, and tropical weather may be what folks think of when they think Florida. But as Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
Each week, we'll bring you a new episode of a true crime case committed right here under the Florida sun. From the outrageous to the utterly bizarre. Think you've heard it all? Think again. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami. It's 1978. A man named Ulan Mitchell has what he described as a revelation that told him that he should leave his current city of Orlando and move to Miami, which he does.
Ulan is a street preacher. At this point, he goes by the name Brother Love. He starts walking the streets of Liberty City, one of Miami's predominantly black neighborhoods.
He'd tell anyone that listens things like, quote, did you know God is black? It's the world's best kept secret, end quote. Or that blacks were God's chosen people.
By preaching day in and day out, he built up a following in the black community. One of those followers was Khalil Amani. A lot of the information in this episode about the Yahwehs comes from Khalil Amani's firsthand experience and from the extensive reporting of the Miami Herald.
He was making the case that the Bible is a history book, and it is the secret history of black people in America, specifically.
As a young black man, Ulan's message connected with Khalil.
And it said things like, did you know that God is black? Did you know that Jesus was black? Did you know that all the prophets were black?
In particular, Ulan's message about national identity resonated with Khalil. Here's a recording from one of Ulan's sermons.
They name their country, and then they say America. And what do you say? I'm black American. But see, that doesn't identify a land.
Here's what Khalil took away from that.
If you ask a man born in China his nationality, he would tell you he's Chinese. But when it comes to black people, you black, you're Negro. And that was, for me, that was really the, yeah, that makes sense.
Now, when Ulan is talking about the Bible, he's not just talking about the New Testament. He's talking about the Old Testament, or what they call the Torah in the Jewish faith.
He says that black people are the true Jews of the Bible. Our real nationality is Hebrew Israelites. Hebrew as the children of Abraham, who was a Hebrew, and Israelites because Jacob was the grandson of Abraham. He was an Israelite. So we became, he told us that we are true nationality, that we are Hebrew Israelites. I never heard nothing like that in my wildest dreams.
This was the beginning of what would be known as Black Hebrew Israelites, or Yahwehs.
Yahweh is the phonetic pronunciation of the Hebrew word for God. In Judaism, it's usually pronounced Adonai or Hashem.
So Yahwehs believed African Americans were the original Israelites. Ulan would quote select passages from the Bible to back this, like one passage about Jesus' hair being rough like wool.
For a young Khalil, enough of it made sense. He describes the Bible as every grandparent would have in their home, filled with beautiful paintings of biblical scenes. Yet, everyone in the paintings was white.
For many black people, we have these big, beautiful Bibles in our home. And inside, all the pictures are depicted of, you know, Europeans, Michelangelo, you know, right, paintings of Jesus and Sistine Chapel and God touching Moses' finger, that, those kinds of things. But it's all Europeans. So it's kind of, it was kind of a culture shock, a religious shock to be reading this man's literature saying that, no, you've been lied to. All those figures in the Bible are people of color. They're not white Europeans.
Ulan's message that everyone in the Bible is black and black people are the chosen people was enough to make Khalil a true believer.
I mean,
And we should point out here that while there's no definitive answer to what Jesus actually looked like, many scholars, including Riza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, have made the point that, like most people from the Middle East, Jesus would have likely had darker features and darker skin, which differs from the Eurocentric way we so often see him portrayed.
Exactly. So it's understandable why the idea of God being black appealed to folks like Khalil. He and his wife became interested and went to weekly meetings. At the time, they'd meet in different members' houses, wherever they could get a room.
Hulon emphasized that God and all the prophets of the Bible were black, and blacks would gain the knowledge of their true history through him.
Hulon changed his name to Ach Moshe, Hebrew for Brother Moses, because like Moses, he believed he was ordained to lead his people to freedom. The early disciples recruited more disciples, going door-to-door in Miami's black neighborhoods, Overtown, Little Haiti, and Liberty City.
Now, this is all happening in the late 70s, within the context of police harassment and mistreatment of black people. The case of one brutal police beating in December 1979 angered people. A black man named Arthur McDuffie was beaten to death by four policemen in Miami. A few months later, in May of 1980, the case went to trial and the police officers were acquitted. The verdict caused an uproar in Miami's black community and manifested into massive protests and riots throughout the community and some very tense race relations that would continue throughout the decade.
The central message of black divinity that the Yahwehs preached felt empowering for a community that was suffering at the hands of extreme brutality.
The Yahwehs functioned like a church, with members tithing or donating a portion of their income to the church.
Eventually, they had enough money to purchase a warehouse in Liberty City. This became their headquarters.
Welcome to International Headquarters for the Nation of Yahweh, who is the tribe of Judah, nation of Israel, Yahweh's chosen people. Our history is Hebrew, our language is Hebrew, our culture is Hebrew.
Members that fully wanted to give themselves to the cause could now live in the temple. Hulon, now Ach Moshe, told them he'd care for them, feed, clothe, and protect them. And someday, he'd lead them out of racist America to the New Jerusalem. Khalil and his wife jumped at the opportunity and moved into the temple.
Ach Moshe asked who would want to be a full-time worker. In other words, give up your life, give up your job, give up your job out of school, whatever you're doing, and come and work for the temple. And he asked my wife and me. We agreed to give up. I dropped out of college. She dropped out of college. I quit my job. And we moved into the temple, and we became full-time workers for Yahweh. We dedicated our life to building up this nation of sorts.
They devoted their life to Yahweh and the Black Hebrew Israelite movement. In Miami in the 1980s, the Yahwehs became known for their very distinct look. They wore white flowing robes, a white turban, a wooden staff called the Staff of Life, and a Star of David, the six-pointed star most commonly associated with Judaism.
It wasn't nothing too deep. It was just that's how we were supposed to look. We didn't want to look like the European Jews and wear the, you know, yarmulkes or nothing like that.
And we're pronouncing Yahweh for you here, but it was written out in Hebrew on any banners or signage associated with the church.
They also adapted other practices associated with Judaism, like keeping kosher and practicing the Sabbath or day of rest on Saturday.
Now, you might be wondering, if they identify as true Israelites, then what about everyone else that identifies as Jewish? Yahweh would preach against the oppression of the white man, and specifically Jews. He called them infidels and oppressors. Here's a recording of Yahweh talking about Israel.
And I'm here to tell you and prove to you that it belongs to the blacks of America. It does not belong to the Jew. He's an imposter. He is false. He's a liar. They're the synagogue of Satan.
Yahweh's sermons would preach things like, quote, who has the power to deliver us from the brutality of the white man, end quote. The congregation would respond, quote, one God, one mind, one love, praise Yahweh, end quote. The church also exuded what folks might describe as cult-like behaviors. According to Khalil, once you became a member, socializing with anyone who wasn't a member was frowned upon. People cut off ties from their friends and family. They became fully devoted to Yahweh.
What is the Yahweh lifestyle?
Well, just basically not being around your family anymore, not hanging out with your family, not hanging out with your friends, pretty much hanging out with only people who were in the Word, as we called it, who were part of the Yahweh temple, people who were part of the Hebrew Israelite lifestyle. He taught that your families aren't your real families. He taught that the Hebrew Israelite nation, that is your real family.
By 1982, Ach Moshe began a transformation.
He started to call himself Yahweh ben Yahweh, Hebrew for God, Son of God, and told his followers he was the Messiah that God had promised them in the Bible. Now, with the temple, Yahweh's stated goal was to clean up the neighborhood. He wanted to revitalize the area, put an end to drug dealing and prostitution. He started to build up a reputation as a redeveloper and rehabilitator of impoverished neighborhoods in inner city Miami.
Using money collected through the church, he purchased more properties, including an apartment building, restaurant, stores, houses, and a hotel in Miami Beach.
The Yahweh's empire grew to amass immense amounts of wealth and power.
His efforts rehabilitating historically poor and marginalized communities made him someone revered and respected as a community leader. They put an end to prostitution and gang activities in certain neighborhoods. They offered shelter to those needing it in some of the buildings. The Miami Urban League even gave him a humanitarian award.
The mayor of Miami, Xavier Suarez, declared Yahweh ben Yahweh Day on October 7th, 1990.
However, the tide started to turn. Less than a month after having a day named in his honor, Yahweh ben Yahweh would be federally indicted for extortion, racketeering, and murder. By the early 1980s, the Black Israelite movement, or Yahwehs, were quickly growing in Miami's African-American community. But where did its leader, Yahweh ben Yahweh, or Yulon Mitchell, come from?
Yulon Mitchell Jr. was born in Oklahoma in 1935. His mother was a nurse and his father was a Pentecostal minister who preached at a tiny Antioch church every Sunday.
Yulon's father struggled to make ends meet, and his childhood was one of relative poverty, made worse by discrimination from Jim Crow laws. He attended segregated public schools, and once he was of age, he joined the Air Force. In 1954, he married his first wife, Nodi May. They had 4 children in 4 years.
It was around this time that he became interested in spirituality. He studied psychology at Enid Phillips University and joined the Rosicrucians, a mystical brotherhood whose members believe they possess esoteric wisdom about nature and humanity. He also became interested in the civil rights movement, organizing sit-ins in Oklahoma. All of Hulon's spiritual and political angsting was too much for his conservative wife, Nodi May, according to Court TV. They divorced after being married for only 4 years. Nodi May signed a waiver relinquishing custody of their children over to Hulon.
Yulon soon grew disillusioned with the civil rights movement. He saw the civil rights movement as, quote, not about becoming free from the oppressor. The civil rights movement was about fighting and dying to get inside of oppression to be better oppressed, end quote. He called Martin Luther King Jr., quote, that dead dog preacher, end quote.
This led to a growing interest in Black nationalism and his getting involved in the Nation of Islam, a movement that emphasized Islam as the true religion of the Black community. Yulon converts to Islam and gets mentored by Elijah Muhammad, leader of the Nation of Islam, who is also the mentor to Malcolm X.
Yulon rises through the ranks of the Nation of Islam. He's assigned to minister a mosque in Atlanta. He moves, takes on a different name, and essentially starts a whole new life. Life in Georgia seemed to go well for him. While in Atlanta, he gets remarried, and he gets a master's degree in economics at Atlanta University. He's able to immediately apply these skills to manage some Black Muslim enterprises, including a few restaurants and a bakery.
Now, there are various accounts of what happens next. One version is there were death threats on his life after the murder of Malcolm X. Another version is that $50,000 went missing from church coffers.
Whatever actually happened, we don't know. But it seems Yulon ultimately feared for his life and left both the Muslim Brotherhood and Atlanta and moved to Orlando, Florida.
It's in Orlando that he has his revelation to move to Miami and create the Yahwehs.
So it's 1981 going into 1982. Khalil and his wife are full-time Yahweh members living and working in the temple.
Each family that lived in the building had a 10 by 15 foot cubicle to live in. There was basically no privacy. They kept a strict schedule, and the days were long.
Day to day was getting up about 5 o'clock in the morning, then finally going to bed about midnight.
And they subsisted on very minimal food. They said it was for dietary reasons, but in reality, it was to save money and keep costs low, according to Khalil.
So he cut out all meat, and the diet became 7 days a week of beans, rice, bread, and water. One day it's black beans, tomorrow's navy beans, garbanzo beans, black beans, string beans, you know, a different bean, but beans every day with white rice every day, water, and a slice of bread. That was the diet. No breakfast and no lunch. And when I tell you that we all, wasn't no fat people in the temple, we all were skinny.
The members that lived in the temple were given a $5 weekly allowance for toiletries and necessities. But it all went back to Yahweh because the only place they could spend the money was in the temple's own store.
Khalil told me there were no days off, no holidays, not even Christmas or Hanukkah.
You worked 7 days a week. There was no getaway on Saturday. I'm going to the movies. I'm going to see my family. No. Your family was dead to you, and there was no weekends. Every day was a work day.
Besides their daily work, each member was required to hit the streets and collect at least $10 in donations.
If you didn't meet your daily minimum, you were sent to the Room of Understanding.
The Room of Understanding. Among the members, it was known as the Punishment Room.
Khalil described it as an empty room with thin carpet you'd have to kneel on while keeping your body erect. Sometimes for an hour, sometimes all day.
So it takes only about 10 to 15 minutes for you to understand what the Room of Understanding is trying to teach you. Severe pain. 15 minutes in on your knees, standing upright with your knees, the pain starts from the feet, the knees, all up to your back, sphincter muscle all the way out, back off to your neck. Within a half hour, you're basically at your threshold of pain.
Now, Yahweh did pick up a few things from his time in the Muslim Brotherhood, including how to run security. Every member was searched when entering the temple, according to Khalil. He also described how Yahweh also had his own private security team. He picked 10 strong men and called them the Circle of 10. They carry wooden clubs, which they call the Staffs of Life.
Yahweh's sermons got more brazen, according to the LA Times. He'd ask, quote, "How many of you would die for Yahweh? Would you kill for Yahweh?" End quote. The response was always yes. Yes, they'd die for Yahweh. Yes, they'd kill for Yahweh.
On top of the cult-like nature of the temple, Yahweh also became a sexual predator.
Yahweh required women and girls to attend midwife classes. He has no medical training. He would have the women undress and inspect each other. He had one woman lie on her back and another blow into her vagina, saying this is how you perform CPR on unborn babies.
He also had sex classes for men and boys. He showed them videos of white women having sex with animals to dissuade them from being attracted to white women.
He would also have them pull down their pants for a DI.
He had what he called a DI inspection or a dick inspection. So one day in brother's class, he made everybody take their damn pants and underwear off. And he personally walked around and looked at every man's penis to see who was circumcised and who was not. And he said, "You cannot go into the congregation of the Lord if you are not circumcised." He told the brothers who needed to be circumcised, knock on wood, I'm circumcised, but those that didn't, he said, $100, $100, this Saturday, come over, I'm circumcising everybody.
That's right. Yahweh had every man drop their pants, and if they weren't circumcised, they had to pay him $100 to do it. A man with no medical training.
And he got down and he cut off foreskin. Oh, yeah, those men screaming and crying. He went down the line. And that was that.
Yahweh's sermons also started planting the idea that sex with him was like sleeping with God.
Yahweh being Yahweh began to teach about the king's seed. He's saying things like, don't worry about where the king's seed go. I'm the king of Israel. I can put the seed wherever I want to. Don't worry about where the king's seed going. How many of you women would love the king's seed? And they're all screaming and, you know, yeah, we want to, you're talking about his sperm, you know, not his sperm.
Yahweh would have late night Bible sessions with women, according to Khalil. Didn't matter if they were married or not.
So he had a thing for married women, single women, and young girls. Anything that looked good to him, he was going to get it.
On top of having late-night Bible sessions with the men's wives and girlfriends, he also preyed on young girls. According to the Miami Herald, he slept with girls as young as 12.
Khalil told us that anyone who disagreed with him or called him out was ostracized and publicly punished. Despite the threats of punishments, some members voiced concern among each other. When Yahweh found out about this, he excommunicated them.
Anyone that left the church were called hypocrites. But this betrayal really bothered him. He said, quote, "If you are my enemy, you must die," end quotes. And some of the members took this to heart.
In 1981, Aston Green was a former member who left but continued to return to the church, where he still had many friends. Khalil told us he was on guard duty.
And so up drives Aston Green, who we had considered part of the hypocrite crowd. So he comes up and, you know, I meet him at the door and ask him, what did he want? He said he wanted to see Akmoshe. I told him Akmoshe wasn't there.
Aston had forgotten his Bible, so he went back to the car to get it.
And when he came back to get his Bible, this guy, Enoch, who was Akmoshe's personal bodyguard, he tells him that Akmoshe is in the temple. If you want to see him, just wait here for a minute. And so I stood there in the foyer with this guy. So Enoch goes away. He comes back with about 8, 9, 10 brothers. So I know this is going to be bad for this guy. Akmoshe had been talking about the hypocrite must die. I didn't know if they were going to actually go through with it, but I knew they were going to beat him up. I knew something was going to go down. So here these 8, 9, 10 brothers come, and they surround this guy, Aston Green, and they take him in the back. And he's in the middle, and he's still walking with a sense of defiance. I'm walking with the whole pack. And he doesn't realize that something's about to happen to him. Enoch tells me, go guard the side door. And then suddenly I hear thumps, bumps, grunts. You know, just I hear a commotion. Curiosity got the best of me. When I peeped around the corner, I saw that he was on the floor. I saw that he was getting stomped on his head. Somebody had, I don't know if it was a hammer, it was an object. They were hitting him with it. He was getting pounded out. And I realized they're really going to kill this guy.
After the meeting, Khalil sees the men carry Aston outside towards an open trunk.
We had some green carpet that we used on our temple floors. They had put that around his face and used duct tape to cover his face up so he couldn't, like, breathe. So he's moaning. Clearly still alive, but I can hear the moans and the grunts and the gurgling of his breath. And they put him in the trunk of the car. Two other brothers get in the car, and they grab a machete, throw it in the back seat, and off they go.
The men drove out to a rock quarry in the Everglades. While Aston was still begging for mercy, they pulled out the machete and beheaded him. The blade was so dull it took 20 hacks to do the job. The next day, a jogger would find Aston's head on a rock.
But Khalil didn't know the last part yet. He was left to clean up the mess at the temple.
While they're gone, we clean it. We go back to the back and there's blood, you know, human debris, teeth and whatever on the concrete. We clean all that up. We get some acid. We clean it up.
There was so much blood on the floor, they would later paint the floor red to conceal all the blood that wouldn't wash away.
We get some floor paint that we had in there, and we paint the floor. So by the time Akmoshe comes back, myself and a couple of brothers, we take him in the corner and basically debrief him on what just happened.
What was Yahweh's reaction when he did hear about the people that he's been talking to, they killed in his name or for him? Was there a reaction? Was there a sense of anything from him?
Oh, yeah. He smiled and laughed and said, "Praise Yahweh. Yahweh is killing our enemies."
When word spread about what had happened, a few former members decided it was time to report Yahweh to the police. But little did they know, there were moles in their midst reporting back to Yahweh about their intentions. And now that one person who betrayed him is dead, he isn't going to stop there.
That was the beginning of the reign of terror on the city of Miami.
It's the end of 1981. Aston Green, a defector from the Yahwehs, was brutally murdered.
Green had two roommates, Carlton Carey and Mildred Banks, both former Yahweh members. They suspected Yahweh was involved in his murder, so they went to the police.
Word about this got back to the Yahwehs. Now, it's not clear if this was a direct order from Yahweh Ben Yahweh, but upon returning from the police station, they were ambushed.
Carrie was shot dead. Mildred Banks' throat was slit with a machete, but miraculously, she survived. She and all the other former members got the message and fled Miami. Yahweh held a party celebrating the death of what he called the infidels. Some members were horrified at what happened, but now they lived in fear, knowing if they showed any doubt, they too could be next.
Now, before the attack, they did get to speak to police about their suspicions on Yahweh.
Police started patrolling the area, and they even interviewed Yahweh. But there was no evidence to move further with an investigation or charges.
But in the surrounding area of the temple in Liberty City, everyone knew not to mess with the Yahwehs.
We had the respect and reverence and fear of even the most hardened street dudes and drug dealers and whatnot. They didn't mess with us. We would have came at you, 50-100 deep.
They would head over to South Beach, which in 1980 was predominantly Jewish and elderly, and walk around in their white robes and turbans and intimidate the elderly Jews in Loomis Park. But there was also a practical reason for their trip. This was the only place to go to buy Star of David necklaces, according to Khalil.
In 1983, Khalil said a new member showed up by the name of Leonard Dupree, a black belt karate expert. Now, Khalil was out of town on church business, but his wife was there, who filled him in through an unauthorized phone call later.
According to Khalil's wife, Dupree threatened Yahweh with scissors. In other versions, Yahweh was paranoid and convinced he was an assassin sent to kill him. What we do know, according to Khalil's wife, is Yahweh openly challenged him to fight another temple member who was also a martial arts expert.
The two men fought in front of 30 to 50 other members, including Yahweh ben Yahweh himself. Dupree quickly knocked out the Yahweh's karate expert. After Dupree's victory, the doors to the room were locked. Yahweh had all the members beat him to death. Everyone in the room was ordered to kick Dupree's body, including children. This way, they would all be bound in blood. A group of men rolled up the body in a carpet and dumped it in a canal. To this day, Dupree's body has never been found.
Despite several murders and police suspicion, the church continued to grow. At its peak, they had satellite churches in 45 cities, supposedly tens of thousands of members, and 500 people living in the warehouse known as the Temple in Miami. Remember, at the beginning of the show, Yahweh was celebrated by the community for revitalizing depressed areas.
Part of the way he did this was by exploiting and abusing his followers. He fed them one meal a day, usually beans. Children were malnourished. Anyone that still had an outside job had to deposit their entire paycheck to the church accounts. He used this to buy rundown apartments. As his influence grew, he was able to get bigger loans. He bought motels, apartment complexes, and grocery stores. Temple of Love Incorporated was worth $8.5 million. It was one of Miami's largest black-owned corporations.
In 2001, the New York Times reported that the empire's value at its peak may have been $100 million.
We cleaned that place up. You weren't going to sell no drugs or no sex around us. And so, black leaders like that because they see that we're cleaning up. But what's the expense? The fear of the community?
In 1986, the Yahwehs firebombed some homes in Delray Beach, where people were complaining about their fundraising efforts in the community, according to the Tampa Bay Times. Also that year, Yahweh takes over an apartment complex in the Miami inner city suburb of Opa-locka. He wants to evict all the residents to make room for Yahweh members to live. Two limousines, six buses, and a bunch of vans and cars pull up to the apartment complex. 75 Yahwehs surround the building, clenching their Staff of Life clubs.
Goals over there. Has his people knocking on doors immediately and saying, get out. These are black people, mostly single welfare mothers.
The residents tried to call the police, but got no response. The Yahwehs forcibly and illegally kicked them all out of their apartments.
Later that night, two of the residents, Anthony Brown and Rudolph Broussard, spoke out against Yahweh and what they were doing. 10 hours later, they were shot dead.
And that night, two black tenants are murdered. How is that black empowerment, black upliftment? It's just the opposite. What black leader in their right mind kicks black people out of their dwelling?
The Opa-locka eviction and killing was the beginning of the tipping point in Khalil's disillusionment with Yahweh.
What fully pushed him over was sneaking out and watching the movie Purple Rain.
That movie opened my eyes up to just life. Just Prince's life paralleled so much of my life. The whole how Prince's father beat his mom. That's what I saw my father do. It told me after I finished watching that movie. There's so much life, not just the bad things, but the good things that Prince dancing and singing, and the music was so beautiful, and the people were beautiful, and they were in the club scene dancing and all, just, and the beautiful women. I just realized I was missing, and it told me, you're out of here. Prince is the one that saved my life.
Khalil faced a tough choice.
I got a wife and two kids, and I know damn well my wife is not where I'm at mentally. And I know damn well if I try to take my kids and leave the premises, that's a death sentence.
Now, while he was technically married, at this point, Yahweh had basically separated the men from their wives, forcing Khalil to live in a separate building from his wife. So Khalil made the tough choice to leave his kids and wife behind. He did inform his wife he was going to leave and asked for a 30-minute head start before she told anyone he was missing, which she agreed to. Khalil walked out of the temple towards the building he was living in, turned down a side street obscured from view, and took off running.
He got on a bus with no money, and to his shock, the driver just waved him by. He grabbed a seat in the back and broke down crying. Khalil was eventually able to track down his brother and father, who offered up a place for him to stay. He tried to lay low and start his life over, but he felt a responsibility to the Black community to stand up to what Yahweh was doing.
It was a Black man who did me dirty. It was a Black man who had another man's head taken off. It was a Black man who killed another Black man and almost killed another Black woman. It was a Black man who was having other Black men killed.
So he went to the FBI.
These are things that made me become a snitch, if you want to call me that, that made me go to the FBI and say, this is what I know. And I told him about the beheading, that I was there when they beat the guy. I didn't care for my life at that time. I didn't care if they say, well, we'll lock you up because you're complicit. I was willing to take whatever came down the pipe. All I knew is it was time to stop this man, because he was using religion. He was a thug using religion as a front to just do his will.
Despite Khalil's firsthand account, the wheels of justice move slow. It would still be a few years before charges are brought against Yahweh. At first, Khalil refuses to go into witness protection, but eventually he's convinced he needs to for his own protection, so he moves to Denver.
In 1985, Yahweh forms a new secret group called the Brotherhood. In order to join the Brotherhood, you must kill a, quote, white devil, end quote, and bring him back a body part, like an ear or finger. They became known as Death Angels. This led to a slew of murders around Miami in 1986.
In April, Glendale Fowler and Kurt Dorr were found stabbed to death in bed in a Coconut Grove apartment. In May, Claire Walters had his throat slashed and left ear cut off.
In July, a male prostitute found the body of James Lee Myers. He was stabbed to death, his right ear cut but not completely severed. In September, a fisherman found the body of Lyle Austin Bellinger. That same day, Raymond Kelly is discovered stabbed to death behind the teepee lounge. One of his ears is gone. The other is found near his car. In October, Harry Byers was stabbed and killed. His left ear was missing. Also in October, Reynaldo Echevarria was stabbed to death.
The FBI continue to investigate Yahweh. They get Robert Rozier, a former NFL player and member of the Yahweh Brotherhood, to confess to 7 murders. 2 of them were the killings of the residents from the Opa-locka apartment. In exchange for testifying against Yahweh, he got a 22-year sentence.
Yahweh feels the pressure of the police investigation, so he goes on a publicity campaign, hiring a media-savvy lawyer to put out a good image of Yahweh in Miami. This is what led to Yahweh Ben Yahweh Day with Mayor Xavier Suarez on October 7th, 1990. Fun side note, Xavier Suarez is the father of Miami's current mayor, Francis Suarez, who has made national news for pushing Miami as a Bitcoin hub.
A few weeks after Yahweh Ben Yahweh Day, a federal grand jury indictment drops, indicting Yahweh and 15 of his disciples of extortion, running a racketeering enterprise, and 14 murders.
Later, Mayor Suarez would say, quote, obviously I was wrong, end quote.
In 1992, the case goes to trial.
Yahweh Ben Yahweh, or Huelon Mitchell, was convicted of racketeering conspiracy, but not first-degree murder. However, he was found guilty of conspiracy in some of the other murders. In court documents, Judge Norman Roetker writes in his order, quote, the case is arguably the most violent case ever tried in a federal court. Beheadings, stabbings, severing of body parts, end quote. Yahweh Ben Yahweh was sentenced to 18 years, but served 11.
He was released on parole in 2001 and returned to Miami, but his activities were strongly restricted. He was prohibited from reconnecting with his old congregation.
and I actually went to school in Liberty City in the late 90s. And though Yao was already in prison and the church had mostly disbanded, I still remember seeing some folks dressed in their white robes and standing on corners preaching. It was a bit surreal given the history of all that happened. So when Mitchell was released in 2001, he actually moved into a house owned by the Yahwehs. There was a news report that he moved back to Miami, but he pretty much stayed out of the public eye. He died in 2007 from prostate cancer.
So hearing about the death of Yahweh Ben Yahweh was a happy moment for me. It's like, okay, he got his just desserts. He's not God. Even though there's a lot of people today, if you go on YouTube and places, they still believe he is who he said he was.
The Yahweh Church is still active. It's since relocated to Texas, but is also active in South Florida and Canada. Looking back, Khalil takes responsibility for his actions. But he believes that if you remove Yahweh from the equation, none of the people charged with murder would have killed, including Robert Rozier, who killed 7 people.
We all were caught up. We got caught up in the madness and brainwashing of being under the spell and disillusionment of a man named Yahweh Ben Yahweh. I would have murdered for Yahweh Ben Yahweh. And I'm no killer, but I would have done whatever Yahweh Ben Yahweh instructed me to do those 5 years I was in there, because I was in it and as brainwashed as Robert Rozier or anybody else. We were killers because we were told to kill. I would have killed.
Do you think there's something about the message that just resonates with people, especially people in the Black community?
It resonates with a lot of Black people because we are people stolen from another land without true history of our identity. That's facts. You know, some people don't want to be African-American. Some Blacks don't want to just be, say, I'm American. Especially when you see the things that happen in the world with police brutality and, you know, George Floyd and stuff that we see every day. There's a lot of people, a lot of Black people, they're disillusioned with this American dream, with this American melting pot. And people like Yahweh Ben Yahweh, they wait in the wings for people to become disillusioned. And they're right there. And they feel, stand in the gap, and they feel the void that a lot of Blacks feel. Yahweh Ben Yahweh was mere mortal man, as I am. And he took a path and caused a bunch of chaos. And I was on that path with him, and I jumped off. And I'm proud of myself that I was able to find myself. So the only good that really came out of that whole thing is that he made me made me more determined to be a better person. Now I've moved from so-called hating white people to understanding the bigger picture of slavery and the racial dynamics.
Khalil has become an advocate for LGBTQ rights and has written 7 books, including My Id, Life in the Yahweh Cult and Witness Protection Program.
Thank you for listening to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, where each new episode will bring you a true crime story right from the South Florida headlines.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a production of Sonoro and Trojan Horse in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Network. Hosted and produced by Kareem Tapsch, Joey Dowd, and Christian Hattar. Edited by Angelina Mosher Salazar. Fact-checking by Evelyn Uribe and Sara Mota. Engineering by Mane Parra, Daniel Padilla, and Fernando Galaviz. Executive produced by Jasmine Romero and Joshua Weinstein for Sonoro, Kareem Tapsch and Alex Fumero for Trojan Horse, and Giselle Bansis and Conal Byrne for iHeart. Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.